and welcome to the OMFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about good governance in Central and Eastern Europe. This is Julie Levy-Bignoli from London, and today we speak to Beate Jaworczyk, Chief Economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Thank you for joining us today. So, first of all, the most recent EBRD transition report is all about the importance of good governance. So how do you define good governance?
Governance is one of those concepts that elude an easy definition. In many languages, actually, there isn't a very good equivalent of the term. But we can broadly think of governance as who has the right to make the decisions, who is or ultimately accountable for these decisions. We can think of governance as institutions, as the rules of the game, the rules that govern society.
Okay. And in the transition report, you found that the pace of improvement in terms of governance in EBRD regions has slowed, and the governance gap between these countries and more advanced economies hasn't changed. It's still the same. So why is that?
Post-socialist countries entered the 1990s with poor institutions. So they had a deficit in terms of governance. They made a lot of progress over the years. Big part of that progress was due to the accession process, accession to the European Union. After they joined the EU, in many of those economies, the zeal to push the reforms further has disappeared. As a result, what we see in our data is that during the last decade or so, our countries of operations made very little progress in improving their institutions. So actually, this governance deficit that they have relative to G7 economies is persistent. Interestingly, you see this governance deficit if you look at indicators such as those compiled by the World Bank, if you ask firms in surveys, or if you ask individuals in surveys. All three sources give you the same picture.
Kind of related to this, you wrote in your bulletin article that, as you just said, these countries over 30 years underwent considerable reform. And for a while, the political and economic transition was successful. But now, you know, these countries face economic slowdown, social inequality, the rise of populism. Some of them have reversed the reforms that they had introduced. So what happened? Is it a case of they were trying to reform to join the EU, and now that they're part of it, they've kind of stopped? Or...
Well, let me address these issues one by one. So many Eastern European countries have experienced spectacular growth in the first few decades after the transition has started. But that growth was an easy growth because they dismantled central planning, they massively invested, they invited foreign direct investment, which brought not just capital, but also know-how, new technologies. In other words, the first few decades of growth were marked by catching up. Catch-up growth is a relatively easy way of growing. Now, a lot of these easy sources of growth have been exhausted. So now, Central European countries need to think about growing through own innovation. And that is much more difficult. And in particular, what we know from our EBRD research is that innovative firms are much more sensitive to the quality of governance and quality of business climate. So therefore, for the region to enter this new stage of growth, countries need to think about improving their institutions. The other issue you mentioned was inequality. In socialism, there was almost perfect equality. There was no link between wages and productivity, and there was essentially full employment. So it was natural that in the first few years after the system change, all of these countries experienced decompression of wages. So suddenly skill premium appeared. People with better education were earning more in most cases. Suddenly, entrepreneurial abilities were rewarded very much by the market. So there was this decompression of wages in the early years. Then, as we observed in other parts of the world, technological progress and globalization have further contributed to growing inequality. So even though our EBRD research shows that in countries such as Poland, people at every decile of income have experienced convergence with the G7 countries. So in other words, they're in absolute terms, they are better off and they have caught up to some extent. The distance between their incomes and incomes of industrialized countries has shrunk. However, people at the top of the income distribution have enjoyed faster growth in income. And because people care not only about the absolute level of income, but also about their relative position, that has led to some discontent. And discontent obviously makes introducing further reforms harder. The reason why the reforms in the early period were easy was because they were guided by the EU accession process. So there was this external anchor which charted the direction of the reforms. So once the country, once the society made the decision that it wanted to join the European Union, it was very obvious what needed to be done. Direction was given by Brussels. And no matter what government was in power, all these governments knew that their mission was to achieve EU membership. Now, once this external anchor disappeared, it became more difficult to introduce reforms because no reform is going to make everybody better off. No reform is going to please everybody. So in some cases, even though a reform will benefit country as a whole, there will be a group that may lose out. And that means that reforms are politically difficult.
And what would you say is the one area of reform these countries should prioritize?
The quality of the judicial system is very important to a well-functioning economy. Independence of the judicial system is very important. Effectiveness, speed of resolution is very important. Firms are much less likely to invest if they are concerned about lack of ability of resolving disputes. So that's the reform I would prioritize.
And you wrote in your article that one issue in Central and Eastern Europe is that these countries face high levels of emigration and a lot of younger, highly educated citizens in the population are leaving to seek better paid jobs abroad. Now, these are countries that benefited from a lot of foreign direct investment over the last 30 years. Some argue that FDI contributes to lowering wages. So do you think this is the case in these regions?
I do not believe that FDI has contributed to lowering wages simply because international experience shows that multinational companies in emerging markets pay higher wages. And there's quite a bit of evidence on that. What has kept wages low in some countries was migration from outside. So for instance, Poland at the moment is a host to almost 2 million Ukrainians. So a big influx of workers from outside certainly keeps the wage level low. Now, these countries have experienced two negative demographic shocks. On the one hand, as they got richer, they went through a typical demographic transition. Number of children per woman went down, as in we observe in other places, women get married later, they are more interested in careers, and as a result, the number of population growth slows down. At the same time, these countries have experienced a lot of outward migration. Once they joined the EU, EU labor markets became open, with a few year difference here and there, in depending on which wave of EU expansion we are talking about. And that meant that a lot of young, often educated people left, either temporarily or permanently, to take advantage of higher wages in Western Europe. And that has led to some shortages of workers, of skills. And some of these shortages have been mitigated through inward migration from outside of the EU. One of the negative effects of outward migration is that it's often the more entrepreneurial, skilled people who leave, and they deprive their country of their skills, and as a result, the country grows somewhat slower. And perhaps what matters even more is that as those who are left behind are older, they are much more focused on short-term policies, on redistribution, rather than investment into future growth. And that's something that, you know, through demographic changes that affects voter preferences may negatively affect growth in the long term. So it's not surprising that Croatia made demographic issues one of their top priorities during their EU presidency.
Moving on now to Green, we published an article recently by a Czech former central banker who argued that the European Commission's new Green Deal is unlikely to garner much support in Central and Eastern European member states because their economies rely much more on industrial production and manufacturing than their Western counterparts, where services are much more important to the economy. Do you agree with this assessment?
Indeed, we see that Eastern European countries are much more dependent on industrial production than countries at the similar level of income. We also know that production in Eastern Europe is more energy intensive than production in Western Europe. Moreover, some Eastern European regions are very dependent on coal. And the fact that industries that are large CO2 emitters, industries that are dependent on coal, are geographically concentrated, will make transition to a low carbon economy much more difficult. Because if you have a high geographic concentration of industries that would be affected, people who live there have much fewer alternative employment opportunities. In order for the low carbon transition to gain support in Eastern Europe, one needs to think about policies, place-based policies, that can take care of people who will be negatively affected. Because without broad-based support of the society, low-carbon transition is unlikely to be sustainable in political terms. Experience with globalization provides us with some lessons. So we know that globalization has made economies richer, but we know that globalization, as well as technological progress, have had negative impact on some segments of the population. And the fact that governments have not always addressed this issue meant that in some countries we now observe a backlash against globalization. So similarly, unless we make sure that people who are negatively affected by low carbon transition are helped, we may observe a similar backlash in a decade or so.
And the EBRD transition report found that in many EBRD regions, green investment tends not to be a top priority for managers. So what policies should governments use to encourage more green investment?
So if you you read financial press, if you go to Davos, you may think that the corporate sector has signed up for the Green Deal. But our transition report shows that this is not true of smaller firms. This is not true of private firms in our countries of operation. We do have firms in our countries of operations that are excellent in terms of green management. But for majority of firms, green management is not a priority. In our survey, we asked firms, have you undertaken an energy saving investment? And if not, why not? Almost two-thirds of firms said that they did not undertake an energy saving investment because it was not a priority relative to other investments. Credit constraint came as distant second reason, with only about 14% of firms saying lack of access to financing prevented them from undertaking such investment. So this result is quite sobering. It shows that in our region of operation, many firms simply do not see green investment as priority, that there is relatively little awareness of the need to undertake such investment. We also see that managers or firms that have incurred losses, financial losses due to adverse weather shocks, are much more aware of the need to be green. We also see that firms respond to pressure from customers and from government taxes. We also see in our firm surveys that foreign affiliates as exporters are much more green. And that's because they are under pressure from their foreign customers or foreign headquarters. So what does it mean? This means that we definitely need to have informational campaigns, but that also means that we need to nudge firms to become more green through government policies. That, you know, we cannot wait for consumer pressure to take care of it. There is certainly need for government action in this area.
Thank you. And one last question. Here at UNFIP, we've just launched our latest gender balance index, which is it's a study we do every year. It tracks the presence of men and women in senior positions at financial institutions. And so you are the EBRD's first female chief economist.
Yes.
What's been your experience working in a mostly male-dominated field, and what advice would you give to young women considering a career in economics?
Economics is a very male-dominated field. So when I was doing my doctoral studies, women constituted 10% of the class. In academia, only about 10% of full professors are female. And I believe that is true in Europe as well as in the United States. So in a sense, I am used to that. And at first, I thought, well, perhaps women are not attracted to the profession. Perhaps it's just like with truck driving. Truck driving is not a profession that's particularly attractive to women. By now, I think I realized that there is need for action, and it is very useful that there is a discussion in the profession about the need to help women have careers. EBRD is quite progressive in this respect. On the executive committee, we have 30% of women, which I think is quite impressive by the industry standards. What advice would I give to women? Women often believe that if they do good work, they will be rewarded because everybody will see how well they work. They believe that there is no need to ask for a better project, for a promotion, for a raise. They actually think of this as being impolite. And I used to think that until actually quite recently. But what I have learned over the years is that it's actually useful to be proactive sometimes and ask for things, not to be afraid to ask for things. Of course, if you do that, do it in a nice way and be prepared to hear no as an answer. But that's not something that should discourage you, or that's not something that you should take personally.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. It's been great to speak to you about reforms in Central and Eastern Europe and things these countries can do to help their economies grow. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to our channel. We are on iTunes and Spotify.